So just a couple of numbers before I introduce Hugh. Microlending is a $70 billion industry. So this is a massive industry. There are hundreds of for-profit and non-profit institutions operating in so many countries around the globe. 200 million people now are receiving microfinance loans. And again, they're often celebrated for pulling people out of poverty. Hugh's book argues that they are actually doing more harm than good. And Hugh will talk about how he got to this place, but he's worked in microfinance with a number of organizations in many countries for the last 10 years. And his book, he doesn't mince words, it's Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. And this is the very last interview Hugh is doing. He's done about 25 so far. So he's a little tired, but he's got great information, so please join me in welcoming Hugh Sinclair. So we're going to talk for about 45 minutes, and then we'll take questions. So think about what you'd like to ask, and we'll take those at the end. So Hugh, before we dive in, why don't you talk a little bit about how you got here? I mean, you spent 2 weeks as an official employee of Enron.
Yeah.
You've worked at many banks, ING, Barings, CDC Capital. They always have these letters, BZW Securities, which is now Barclays Capital. How did you end up here?
Yeah, well, I'm an economist, and I worked in investment banking for a few years, and then eventually became fairly bored of it, that, you know, handing pieces of paper from one side of the desk to the next and buying trivial bonds and selling them in different places at small profits. It just seemed a bit of a pointless life. So I decided to go and do an MBA. That was very interesting. And then became the last ever employee of Enron, which was even more interesting. And then when Enron collapsed, I just thought, well, you know, maybe this mainstream banking just isn't ready for me. But I've only ever done economics and finance, so I'll try and do something useful. So I believed all the hype, and I thought, oh, microfinance seems to be combining, you know, the sort of academic and financial expertise with contributing to poverty. So that was really, I just drifted into it slightly by default after Enron, really.
And are all of you familiar with microfinancing? Have any of you given money to microfinance institutions? Oh, quite a few. All right, so why don't you just give us a brief synopsis of how this works?
Okay, well, we're all familiar with the sort of the romanticized image. Usually it's a woman with a goat or a sewing machine or some little shop. That's what we're all told is the typical microfinance sort of model. And she gets a loan for usually, we think it's like $50 or $100. It's usually closer to $1,000 or a little bit more. And then with this loan, she's going to build up her business, and it's going to be some income-generating business, and that's going to help her to, you know, elevate her level of income, have enough money to be able to repay the loan, pay a little bit of interest, and then she's left with the goat afterwards. The loan can be recycled to the next person, and she can then live happily ever after with this goat and living off the milk and all that. That's the kind of the romanticized image. The reality is very, very different. Those are rare snapshots. They're like the national lottery winners, and we sort of ignore all the other people who bought a ticket and didn't win the national lottery. The vast majority of microfinance is actually used for consumption and for repaying loans to other microfinance institutions. So if you have this idea that your money is going to just this 200 million goats dream on, it's going to clothes, buy TVs, going out for dinner, whatever. It's going on, a large part of it is going on consumption. And then what's happening now, probably the biggest single threat to the entire sector is the over-indebtedness of the poor, because we're now seeing huge credit crisis in a number of countries where the poor are just taking a loan from one bank to repay the next, repay the next, repay the next. So no one really knows, and no one wants to know, and the banks don't have any incentive to reveal the extent that this is to which this is happening. But yeah, certainly the majority, and I mean, some estimates stretch as high as 90%. There was a Harvard Business Review a few years ago that suggested that up to 90% of microfinance is used on consumption.
I was under the impression that the interest rates might be 10, 15, 20%, and it was shocking to read that they go as high as 195%.
Yeah, I mean, the famous one, Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, you know, who won the Nobel Prize with Muhammad Yunus, and they charge quite reasonable interest rates, about 20, 24% thereabouts. If you look at some countries where there's very good regulation, like in Ecuador, the interest rates are capped, so you're not allowed to charge more than 30%. But no, a lot of microfinance institutions charge 50, 60, 70 is completely normal. That's pretty acceptable. When you get to sort of above 100, really that's only pockets. That's a few countries in Latin America, and maybe I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, half of Africa. And then when you get to the really extreme levels, which I sort of define as over maybe 120, 130, when I would call mid-range. Yeah, when you get to sort of approaching 200, then really that's only Mexico. That's the most expensive place in the world now. 195% is the highest independently verified interest rate, and that's an institution which is considered to be the benchmark institution of the entire microfinance sector. It's the first bank to do the IPO, the stock market flotation. It's called Compartamos in Mexico. And they are generally considered to be the evil money lenders dressed up as a microfinance institution. However, they made vast sums in the IPO for their investors, and so they're considered to be the model for the rest of the sector. That's the problem.
And so when you focus on that specific institution, can you give us some names? Who's actually investing there? Because the other image you have is that you might give $500 to this institution, they give $400 to a woman in Bangladesh, and everybody's happy, right? You don't sort of think of Wall Street when you're dealing with microfinance institutions.
Yeah, that's one of the things which I did in the book, which is different to all the other publications in microfinance, is instead of just focusing on what's going wrong in the field, I try to trace the financing back. And what you see is that the financing comes from a relatively small group of investors. In the case of Compartamos, the two big investors were the IFC, of course, they're present in most of these types of institutions, the International Finance Corporation.
And where are they located?
I think they're in DC, aren't they?
Okay.
Yeah. But then Acción is the big US NGO. They were the big shareholders in Compartamos. They saw a $1 million investment at the IPO was worth $270 million. So that was probably the single most profitable transaction ever in microfinance history. And then as this happened, as people began to realize that there were the IPO potential and that this was not just making a few million here and there, but you could actually make tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, that was really when it attracted the vultures. And so you now see just these microfinance funds and investment banks piling in. There's a new fund, they pop up like mushrooms. You know, every week there's a new one offering some slightly different type of goat sewing machine photograph on their website, but basically it's all the same thing. So in the US you've got the Wall Street players, you've got Deutsche Bank, Citi, Standard Chartered. Those are the ones that I focus on. And then you've also got Grameen Foundation, Calvert Foundation, which quite a few people have heard of.
Socially responsible investing.
Apparently, yeah. Mm. And then obviously Kiva, which is the San Francisco people. So Kiva is now, I think, doing about $100 million a year. It's grown quite big.
We invited Kiva to join the radio show today, and they weren't able to come on. And Kiva, you write about Kiva in your book.
Yep.
They got your book, 6 weeks before it came
out?
Yeah,
What's
really interesting is the groups that you write about have not responded publicly.
Yeah, it's very strange because historically, if you look at the last 5 years last sort of 3 years, when serious criticism of microfinance started entering the public domain. So you had whistleblowers leaking stories to newspapers, you had academics coming in and actually raising some very awkward questions. The traditional response is attack, attack, attack. That's the normal thing. So we say it's shoot the messenger, ignore the message. That's the general thing. So they do smear campaigns, and you have academics having their funding cuts, you get threats, you get cut off from conferences. This is the standard operating procedure. But actually, in this case, one of the big flaws in the book is that I anticipate sort of that these people are going to come out guns blazing. And in fact, they've been totally silent. We've not had a single press release, not a single denial, not a single question. They haven't turned up at a single event. They haven't called into a single radio. And it's difficult to speculate as to why this might be, but one of the reasons is that All 250 footnotes have got all the supporting documents on the website, including all the transcripts and original audio recordings of phone calls with these people, with the leaked emails, with the rating reports, with court rulings, the entire lot in an act of total, complete transparency, including documents that make me look ridiculous. It's all on the website, yeah? And so, you know, the knee-jerk reaction to just deny everything and just, you know, claim that the heretic is insane doesn't really work in this case, because, you know, I just say repeatedly, if you don't believe any of this, footnote 83, fast forward to minute 17 and listen to the woman say it in her own words. So, it's shocked the sector, I think.
You've done a lot of work with microfinance institutions in Mexico, for example, Nigeria. Talk a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes. When did you first start questioning this industry?
The first concerns were actually in the very first institution that I worked at, which was in the state of Chiapas in southern Mexico. And I noticed that there were a lot of not very poor people getting loans, and they weren't using it for any entrepreneurial activity. And the interest rates were quite high. And I sort of thought, well, you know, I guess maybe this isn't a very good bank. So then I worked with another one, which was marginally better. But I then thought, well, maybe this is a problem in Mexico. I'll go to Mozambique. So we moved to Mozambique, where we were there for 2 years, and discovered some quite outrageous behavior. In particular, taking client savings and using them to pay salaries to, you know, white, well-paid, supposed managers being flown in fact, in that case, from the United States. And we're just stealing the client savings and then just saying, eventually they just declared bankruptcy, but not after a lot of people lost all their money. So, you know, that was kind of disappointing. So I then thought, well, if I work in an investment fund, then maybe I'll be able to, because I've seen how microfinance can and cannot work, maybe if I work for an investment fund, then I'll be able to help them, guide them to where they can, you know, make sensible investments. And that was really when I became really worried about the sector, because then I realized the funds that we entrust our money to, that you guys entrust your money to, the intermediaries, yeah, you assume that they're acting in your best interests and that they're acting in the best interests of the poor. But if you think about that, that's actually a ridiculous assumption. Why would these people act in anyone's interests other than their own? And it was really there that I began to realize this isn't just a few isolated bad microfinance banks. This is an entire sector which is structured in such a way to benefit certain people and not others.
On a side note, it was shocking to read that when you left Chiapas, a Walmart was opening.
Yeah, Walmart and a, you know, multi-screen cinema and a McDonald's and Burger King. Yeah, that was really sad. It was a good time to leave. And also that was when Calderon declared war against the drug traffickers, which was also a good time to leave.
What about regulation? How is this industry regulated?
Yeah, they haven't thought of that yet, bizarrely. There are exceptions. There are some individual countries where the regulations are quite good. Actually, Bangladesh is relatively good. India is now relatively good after the scandals. Ecuador is quite good, Bolivia is quite good. Some of these countries are quite good, but the vast majority of them are completely and utterly unregulated, particularly with the NGOs. The banks doing microfinance, they're usually under some form of banking regulation, but the NGOs, total zero regulation. So you can really do whatever you want. The aggressive, in India, there was a big scandal about banks using very aggressive debt collection techniques against some of their defaulting women, which actually led to 54 cases of suicide, of loan officers just hounding and humiliating and just confiscating all the assets and eventually leading these women to commit suicide. There were cases of forced prostitution where it was the only way that the women could repay the loans. And then there was one case of a teenager being kidnapped as collateral for a loan. Teenager was forced to work as a prostitute. When she was released, she then a week later committed suicide. So that was probably the darkest moment in microfinance history so far. But this can happen. This can happen any day because there's no one regulating it. And there's no one regulating it here either. This is what people forget, is they always focus on developing countries. But when you make an investment in pretty well any, even if you go to something like Deutsche Bank Microcredit Fund, which is obviously owned by Deutsche Bank and Deutsche Bank's regulated by the SEC, even in those cases, and particularly when you look at the foundations and the NGOs, the 501Cs, these are totally 100% unregulated in the United States in practice. You know, if you think that the IRS, who is technically the regulator for an institution such as Kiva, if you think that the IRS is actually looking at where that Kiva money is going in Papua New Guinea and making sure that that woman is being treated fairly, dream on. There's zero, zero regulation. So when you enter into this sector, you have to realize that you are in a totally and utterly, you're in the Wild West. There's zero transparency, zero regulation, and it's very, very murky.
What about media coverage of this? Because again, you often hear so many glowing opinions about microfinance. Can you talk a little bit about how the media got involved when women in India committed suicide and what happened after it got coverage?
Yeah, I mean, this sector has got an incredible spin operations supporting it. It's got some of the biggest PR companies. I don't know if you're aware of Burson Marsteller, the guys who did the Facebook smear campaign against Google, that was Burson Marsteller. The guys who defended General Pinochet, the exploding breast implants, Union Carbide, Big Tobacco. The PR company that does that now works for the microfinance sector, which is a little bit disturbing. But they've got these excellent websites. Every one of these companies has got a PR company that supports them and does all this, presents all this spin, these lovely photographs, all this sort of stuff. So when the Wall Street Journal first broke the story of the suicides in India, the head of the biggest Indian microfinance institution, SKS, came out guns blazing, criticizing the Wall Street Journal for sloppy journalism, for reducing their standards, for presenting falsified data, and that this was a complete and utter disgrace and was a shame that the Wall Street Journal had resorted to such tabloid measures. That was 1 year before the Indian government published a report of 54 reported cases of suicide. So it's spin. It's just perpetual spin. That's the problem.
So talk a little bit about what happens when the women, and they're mostly women we're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Do you have a percentage?
No, I mean, it varies. It's difficult to find out exactly how many women there are globally in microfinance. I mean, it's certainly the majority. The problem is when you go to the institutions, a lot of institutions have an incentive to lie about the number of women because they want to get the women dollar, yeah? And so that, if they can sort of say, well, you know, we're 90% women, it's much easier for them to fundraise. And then also, on the ground level, when men want a loan, they know it's much easier if they get the wife to go and get the loan. And also, she's the one who pays the consequences if they don't repay the loan. She's the one who's liable. So it's really very difficult. But I mean, there are some institutions which are 100% women. The one that I talk about in the book, LAPO in Nigeria, that's 88% women, according to them. But I mean, yeah, usually it's very rare that you would ever have a bank that's less than 60, 70% women. Yeah. So, which is great. If microfinance is working, it's skewed in favor of the women. If microfinance isn't working, it's the women who are suffering disproportionately. That's the really unpleasant.
And so one of your arguments is that if you've got 100% interest rate and you're getting a $200 loan, you're paying back another $200. And so you're going into even deeper poverty at that point.
Yeah, we're told that the poor are, they refer to it colloquially as they're interest rate insensitive, which means that it doesn't really matter what interest rate you charge them because their businesses are so phenomenally profitable that if you charge them 20% or 200%, they don't apparently notice, yeah, which is just totally and utterly ridiculous. The bottom line is that most of the women who work in, who actually have an enterprise, this, we're excluding the ones who just use a loan to pay off another loan in the consumption loans, yeah. When they actually invest in a business, it's not a rocket science business. It's usually buying tomatoes in one place, selling them in another, yeah. And there's this idea that these poor countries are not, their markets are not competitive. But that's obviously not true. The poor are very price sensitive because they're poor. And they will hunt around. If they know that they can buy tomatoes for 1 cent cheaper, they will. And if someone comes into a marketplace and starts selling cheaper tomatoes, they will quickly dominate the market because, you know, information travels very quickly in these markets. So what happens is that there's a very quick response time that you don't see in maybe so much in America, where a few women will get a loan and they will buy their tomatoes or whatever. And they will maybe be able to undercut the other people in the market. Yeah, and they'll only be able to do this by selling a much higher volume of tomatoes and at a slightly lower price, because that's their sort of their model for growing their business. So there are two things that happen, which, if you think about it, it's just normal economic sense. It's economics 101. The first thing is that other people in the market start seeing their market share being eroded, and so they respond. And the easiest way for them to respond is to take a loan to do exactly the same. So that's why microfinance banks love markets, because you can go into a market, and once you've created that critical mass, you know, you've got the first 5-10 women, yeah, it snowballs. Everyone in the market has to get a loan, because otherwise they're going to get they're going to get squeezed out. So that's the first law of economics that the microfinance sector doesn't believe in. The second one is when you get an entrepreneur who's actually got a, let's say that there's a woman who does a really viable business and she actually sets up a new type of tomato stall, and maybe I know she's doing tomato delivery or whatever it is, you know. What about the total demand for tomatoes in these communities doesn't change? You know, it's the supply changes. Microfinance affects the supply of goats and meat and milk and all this sort of stuff. But why would the demand increase? So what you see is that for every entrepreneur who's actually doing really well, you're driving another entrepreneur out of business. Yeah. Now, they call it in economics job displacement or crowding out. Those don't appear in the statistics of microfinance because by definition, they're not microfinance clients. So we don't need to measure them. So you can go into a market and you just say, we lent to 50 people, and these 50 people, look at them, 35 of them are doing better. Maybe. Even if that were the case, what about the other 100? Just ignored.
We got a lot of questions on the show today about the good microfinance institutions. We had one man call in, I'm forgetting the name, it's in the South Bay, and they provide loans to people in Los Angeles and the Bay Area.
Opportunity Network.
And he actually agreed with Hugh. I was thinking he was going to call in and say, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. But he said, yes, there's not much transparency in the industry, unfortunately. And then we were also joined by an organization, I'll find the name in just a minute, another microfinance institution, and they also, here it is, Zedisha, the first peer-to-peer microlending service to offer direct interaction between lenders and borrowers, they also agreed with Hugh and said there's not much transparency.
You know what? The thing which is really interesting is when you speak to microfinance experts, whatever they call themselves, they have the standard patter that they can run off about, you know, empowerment and all this sort of stuff. But when you actually call them aside and you have a private chat with them, I mean, everyone knows what's going on. This is the problem. I mean, you know, You have the U.S. academic David Rudman published a report, published a book actually, about a year ago, called Due Diligence. And in it, he says the overall impact from all my studies is that microfinance actually has zero impact. And you know, this was a shock to the general public, but no one in the microfinance sector was remotely surprised. They're like, oh, it's annoying that someone's gone and written a book about it. And that, you know, and that Time magazine picked up on it and actually wrote impact of microfinance is zero. But I mean, it's no surprise. I mean, when you live and work in these places, like I've been doing this for 10 years, 8 of which has been living in these countries. When you're just surrounded by it all day, I'm hard pressed to think of a single case where it's really worked in anything other than a few isolated people. I mean, it's just, I've been in what I knew. 30, 40 countries, and I'm really hard-pressed to think of anywhere where it's really working.
You, in your book, you contrast these two quotes. One is from New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who says, quote, microcredit is undoubtedly the most visible innovation in anti-poverty policy in the last half century. And then the article you just mentioned, Time World, says, quote, on current evidence, the best estimate of the average impact of microcredit on the poverty of clients is zero. So you've got somebody like a Nicholas Kristof, who has a regular column in the New York Times, who travels to places like Sudan and writes about the poor. basically saying that this is the most visible innovation in anti-poverty policy.
I mean, it's visible. He's correct on that. I mean, the problem with all these, you know, these sorts of commentators, and then also with all the, you know, you've got all the celebrities, you know, you've got all these nice royal family people, Bono's into microfinance now, and, you know, the Simpsons, you've got the Queen of Spain's had a she's mad keen on it as well. You've got all these fancy people going in, and they get flown down to some poor place in their jet, and they get taken to see two or three isolated cases of women that are supposedly doing very well, and then they start talking about it. I mean, I've actually, you know, this is the book's called Confession, so I can confess this. And I've done, I took a large investor and a rating agency to go and see some microfinance clients of a bank that I was working with in Mexico. And they were just brilliant. I mean, there were these bunch of, there were all these women, and they were stitching the embroidered, you know, handcraft things, whatever. And it was very beautiful, very colorful and everything. And they were all hardworking, and they said this wonderful story about how they used to be poor and now they're empowered, and they feel they've all come together and the community is much stronger and better and everyone's happy for it. And about 6 months later, I was in their village and I went up to them and said, you know, are you, how's it all going with the loans? And they were like, what loans? They weren't clients, they were paid actors. And you just have each institution has its own kind of, maybe they are former clients, maybe they are clients, but you have just like your little, the people, when you get those people in the suits, you come down, you've got to take them to this place. So when I go to a microfinance institution, the first thing I do when I go into the field is I say, I pick a loan officer at random, and I say, right, I want to go out with that loan officer. And I usually pick someone who's not too young, who's been there for like 2-3 years, not too integrated, but not just wet behind the ears, yeah? And I say, I just call the person, I say, right, I want to go out with you on Wednesday at 4. So there's no way that they can control what they're doing. And I will get the loan repayment schedules, and I will know Wednesday at 4 who they're going to see. And I will go and visit, I'll go with them to see those specific clients, and I will have a chat with the client, and then I will just turn to the loan officer and I say, right, can you leave now, please? And then I'll have a private chat with the client. It's the only way you can do it. If you don't do totally random spot checks, it's so easy. When you've got these people, they come down, these investors, you know what they want. They want a nice story. They want to see a balance sheet that balances. They want 5 new photos for their website. And as long as you can prove that you're profitable enough to repay the loan, that's all they want, and that's what you give them. And that's the game that everyone's playing. So if you don't play that game, you're just not going to get an investor. So it's generally a facade, to be honest.
And you actually have access to people who work at these institutions who are so disgruntled, but they're not going to confess. So they're feeding you information on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't a one-man effort, I have to say. I mean, I know lots of people in these institutions. So that's some of the microfinance funds and the peer-to-peer lending platforms and within the institutions on the ground. And there is, I mean, it's people are quite open to talk about things generally. And then when they realize, you know, oh, this is getting quite delicate, they'll often be anonymous. I think I say in the book, thank you to all the co-heretics. I won't name you because you'll be fired like I have been. But, you know, no, there's definitely a lot of discontent now in the sector. But, you know, it's your job. People need to, you know, put food on the table, and they know that the work that they're doing is not having any impact. But you know what? You know, what other job are you going to get in rural Nigeria? You know, if someone's going to pay you to go around offering out loans, then hey, do it.
And you write that what began as a good idea gradually became hijacked by the large investors. A new wave of dot-coms muddled with media hype. Poverty reduction has been marginal. So it started out as kind of a smaller, sort of the smaller institution that we visualize, and then a lot of investors saw the potential for massive profits.
Yeah, I mean, Muhammad Yunus is the guy to really listen to. I mean, he said, you know, microfinance is about providing affordable credit to, you know, vulnerable people, you know, poor people, mainly women, for them to do an entrepreneurial activity to work their way out of poverty. Brilliant, brilliant idea. None of us do it. That's the problem. We preach this one thing, that this is what we say that we're doing, but what we actually do is the exact opposite. So then look at what Muhammad Yunus says, you know, I think it was 2 or 3 years later. I can't believe that we've become the precise loan sharks that I sought to replace. And this is the reality. Over the last sort of 10, 15 years, they call it the commercialization, as a polite word, of the microfinance sector. And what basically happened was the investment funds, the investment community began to realize, ah, yes, there's profit here. And they just sneaked in and just took over the entire sector, just slowly, one country at a time. And the problem now that you have, is if you're a good institution and you're trying to actually do good microfinance, you can't get any money. No one will invest in you. Because if you're charging low interest rates and you're offering, you know, healthcare and you're offering other services with your loans, then, you know, you might be having a positive impact on the poor. But when, you know, Deutsche Bank Microfinance Fund and Blue Orchard and Triple Jump and all these monster funds turn up at on your doorstep, and they say, well, look, this guy's got a return on equity of 15% and might be about to transform from an NGO to a private limited company, and we might be able to buy some shares in that, and then we can potentially reach the real holy grail, which is the IPO. Yeah, and you've got a return on equity of 1%, and you don't have any intention of becoming profitable. You know, who do you think they invest in? So the good guys it's not just that there's not many of them, it's that they're getting squeezed out. It's getting more and more difficult by the day to actually be ethical. That's the really disturbing thing about it, really.
Well, and for those in the audience who raised their hands and said that they've given money and maybe still give money to these institutions, what advice do you have for them? How can you determine what's a sort of a good and a bad microfinance lender?
I mean, I try in the book, in the last chapter, I go through like series of things that you need to look out for. Because if you're sitting in America, you have no way of knowing the difference between a good bank and a bad bank. Now, the problem is that even when I'm living in these countries and I'm working with these banks the whole time, there's still, even to this day, even 1 week ago, I've been tricked by a bank with yet another angle on exploitation that I've never seen before. It's quite, I'm constantly learning about this, yeah. But even I struggle, and I can, if I was ever going to invest in microfinance, which I probably wouldn't, but if I was, I've got this inside information. I know, I've got experience, and I can spot the difference between a good one and a bad one. You know, with all due respect, you guys have very little experience in this, so you have to trust an intermediary. And so a lot of the questions that I highlight in the book is not what you need to ask about, you know, the poor person, about what they're doing in their business. It's what you need to know about the intermediary that you're trusting. Yeah, because frankly, as far as me personally, I do not know of an intermediary that I would invest through. I don't know, I can't think of a single one, really. It's very, very difficult to think of one. Because their incentives are not aligned with mine. I want to give my money at a reasonable interest rate or zero. Yeah, a lot of investors just want to make inflation. If they can just cover inflation, they're perfectly happy with that. And they want the poor people to get a decent loan, you know, and that will help them out of poverty. So the ultimate source of money and the ultimate destination, those interests are completely aligned, but you have to go via someone else, and that's where the problem is. So my advice to people is, if you're going to invest in microfinance, what the real analysis you need to do is, who are you trusting your money with? And that is where all the problems are. And it's very difficult because they all look the same and they all give you no information. They give you hype, they give you spin, they give you nice photos of goats. But actually, what information do they really give you is minimal.
You, in some cases, you can't even find out the interest rate.
No,
you've tried.
Yeah, we had a look on Kiva today. I mean, you know, Kiva will tell you, you know, this. They'll sometimes give you, you know, pages of information about this woman and what her hopes and dreams are, and where she's come from, and how many kids she's got, and what she's going to do with the money, and she wants to get this goat, and how long the loan is, and they give you reams of information. They get nice photographs. You know, they manage to get all this information. What's the interest rate? Not on the website. You know, I mean, when you talk about transparency, I'm not talking about really thorough, deep due diligence, you know, going into every last detail. I'm talking about, it's a loan, what is the interest rate? I mean, if you went to a bank and said, I'd like to get a mortgage, and the guy goes, that's fine, and he won't tell you the interest rate, you'd be suspicious, yeah? Yeah, well, this is Kiva. They don't publish it. They don't see it as a relevant statistic.
What about the people on the receiving end? Because you dedicate your book to the entrepreneurs struggling to create a better world, but in particular to those paying interest rates of over 100% a year to line the pockets of a few microfinance banks and their investors. What about the poor that are supposed to be helped? I mean, what does this mean for them?
Yeah, it's catastrophic for them, because what happens is they generally, you know, they're in a vulnerable situation, and they're not, you know, there is an element of desperation. I don't want to say all poor people are desperate, but, you know, there is an element of like, I'm in a bad situation, I want to get out of this, I want to get ahead in life. And, you know, a lot of them have struggled for many years and they don't see a lot of progress. And then a bank comes along and says, haha, if you take this loan, you'll be out of poverty. You know, just buy this goat, just do this, whatever. And it's like this offer of hope. And they take this offer and they work. And often, you know, they will work very hard and they will generate genuine additional income. The problem is that that income is just siphoned off as by way of interest. So then they think, oh, well, maybe it's because I didn't get a big enough loan. Maybe I should get another loan. That one was only $200, but now they're offering me $400. This is the standard microfinance model. Start them small and build them up slowly. You know, 200, 400, 800, 1,000, 2,000. It's like that. That's the sort of general method. So they work harder and harder and harder. And, you know, after 5 years, you get to a point where, you know, they're pretty well where they started. Sometimes they can say, well, I've now managed to tile my restaurant, or, you know, I've got $500 saved up in the bank. Okay, maybe. But you look at me and you think, you just worked for 5 years, and actually what impact did it have on you, if it had any at all? In those 5 years, think of the amount of money that you contributed to these microfinance banks. And what did you get in the end? You got some tiles. You know, it's just, it's heartbreaking. And often, when I'm with these poor people, I just look at, you know, I'm meeting them in the field, and I just sort of, my advice is really just, I'm sorry, I haven't got a nice, easy solution for you to get out of your situation, but frankly, don't take a loan, because this is not going to work for you. And that is, yeah, a lot of the clients, I'm afraid.
Can you give us insights about what people who work for these institutions, just their opinion of the people they're supposed to be helping? You mentioned today that in the past, if there was a microfinance conference, they would bring, you know, the black woman with the traditional dress, and they don't even do that anymore.
No, I remember when I first started going to conferences, there'd always be some people selling stuff that their clients had made. You could buy the little drum, or you could buy the sort of, you know, the Mexican embroidered something or other. Now it's just suits. The big buzz thing now is, you know, forget just direct lending. It's private equity. That's really where the conversations are. So it looks like a traditional Wall Street meeting. There are no colorful costumes. They don't even bother with the slides. They don't even have photos generally of poor people. It's just, let's just get straight to the numbers. How quickly can we ramp this thing up? IPO it. These are the investors. What's the return on equity? So yeah, the poor really don't get much of a mention anymore. You know, they're just like a kind of, they're a vehicle. They're just a means to the end, you know, unfortunately.
So what do you think is in store for this industry? I mean, we were talking about, you know, now is the end of your tour. And what are you hoping comes from this book? What happens in the next 6 months when it comes to microfinance?
Well, I mean, now we're having scandals. They're almost weekly. You know, I could write another book, you know, on the scandals that have happened since I was writing this book. I think in a way, it's now entering into a really delicate period, because people are beginning to lose faith in it, and they've just seen one too many news articles, and it's like, no, hang on, this is another person. This is another person. This is another story. This is happening in Africa, and people are beginning to see the pattern. And, you know, one good sign which is happening now is that the regulators are beginning to wake up to this. So, I mean, you know, to be honest, I've been having quite more phone calls from the regulators than I have from any of the microfinance investment community. You know, and people are beginning to wake up and say, you know what, we need to stop this. This has gone on too long now.
And where exactly?
Well, I know that the countries that are, let's just say, investigating, you know, the regulatory structure is Holland, India, the US, and Switzerland. Those four countries account for probably 90% of all private capital going to the microfinance sector. So if you can regulate those four countries, you can have quite a big impact. So I'm optimistic that that's going to happen. But I think the only other thing which is I'm hoping that this book will lead to is if the general public, if people like you start voting with your wallets and holding these institutions accountable and saying, you want my, you know, whether it's $25 on Kiva or you want my $50,000, I think Deutsche Bank now has $100,000 minimum investment for their fund, yeah? Wherever you are on that spectrum, and you start saying, well, you know what, until you can tell me this, I'm not going to invest in you. And that, I'm afraid to say, the only way that I've come across in the last decade that these people will ever make any change. You can give them all the evidence you want. You can absolutely prove to them that they are directly involved in mass exploitation. And they will even agree. I mean, there are cases in the book where they say, yeah, no, you're completely right. But, you know, no one knows, so we're just going to carry on. The only things that will work with these people is if you threaten their income source or you threaten them with publicity, adverse publicity, particularly now. Now they're all in a panic because now there's just... it's just a torrent of bad publicity. But until people start voting with their wallets, nothing's going to change.
Have you gotten national media attention? I mean, you worked with the New York Times on a few stories before the book came out.
The first big story that I leaked to the press was on the front page of New York Times in April 2010. And that was a great story. And it was a landmark story because it was the first big scandal that actually named three of the investors. So it named Calvert Foundation, Kiva, and Deutsche Bank on the front page. So it was the first time when people started saying, where does the money actually come from? Before it was just like, oh, there's another nasty one in India. Oh, there's another nasty one in Nigeria. This was the first article that really proved that. But yeah, since then, I mean, it's been on Bloomberg, it's been the Telegraph. The media coverage has been pretty extensive.
Do you believe in the main goal of microfinance without all of the corruption?
Yeah, microfinance without corruption is sometimes a harder thing to imagine. But I think the core idea of providing affordable capital to a certain subset of the poor is valid. And I think that there are a few institutions that are doing that. And if you say that is... the people who say it's all nonsense and it should all be scrapped, well, then by extension, they're saying that all venture capital is useless, that all investment capital... I mean, they're basically throwing out the entire capitalist system. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to do that. But do you then say, well, all poor people are entrepreneurs? You know, they've got 200 million clients now, and the microfinance community is very open. It says, we want a billion. That's the goal. Are all billion people entrepreneurs? I mean, if everyone in this room got $1,000, I mean, how many people in this room could turn $1,000 into 1,020? I mean, how many people here, with the level of education and the experience, and you've got your Silicon Valley and everything, could you get a 20% return? You know, it's an open question. Now, you go to Papua New Guinea, and give people who are often so illiterate that they can't sign the contract, but they sign it with their fingerprint. Mm-hmm. And you tell them, you need to make 90% return just to pay the interest. Yeah, I mean, does it sound sensible? Now, there are a few genuine entrepreneurs, yeah, but they're few and far between, just as they are in the rest of the world. And it's not so scalable, that's the thing. You can't make vast sums of money. And they're difficult to find, and you actually have to work with them, and you actually have to help them with their business, you know. And that's expensive, and it's tiresome, and you have to have staff, and it's really, you know, it's not very profitable. So it's much better to just blanket, just carpet bomb an entire country, and just say, there you are, there's $500 million, divide it up amongst yourselves. And the classic case is Nicaragua, which was like, so.
Sure.
The Nicaragua case was amazing. In 2001, there was basically no microfinance in Nicaragua. You then had the biggest influx of microfinance for the size of the country that's really ever happened. It reached 420 million by 2008, and then a year later had collapsed to 170. And it became so flooded with microfinance. There were microfinance institutions everywhere. People were borrowing money. Everyone had a loan. Everyone had multiple loans. When they did the autopsy after the crisis, there was one woman had managed to obtain simultaneously 19 loans, and there are only 19 banks in Nicaragua. She was borrowing from every single one, passing a loan from one to the next, next, next. There was another guy who, he was the most indebted. He had managed to rack up $600,000 in loans from microfinance institutions. You know, it's completely ridiculous. And so you had this huge over-indebtedness, the entire thing collapsed. And the really awkward thing for the microfinance sector was, when the thing collapsed, it was a grassroots movement. It was these 30 people in the north of Nicaragua who just said, forget it, we're not going to repay the loans. And the banks actually managed to imprison these people, and their families rebelled, and they had all these protests, and they then blocked the Pan-American Highway. And then I have to admit, the poor didn't do a particularly wise thing. They kidnapped some of the staff of one of the banks, and they burnt down two branches, which wasn't very good. But anyway, the movement spread across the country, and it became called No Pago, this movement No Pago, which is I won't pay. And suddenly, it was like, well, it's okay, we had 30 people who didn't repay, that's one problem. Now we've got 3 million people who are refusing to repay. And at that point, the government switched sides and said, you know what, you guys don't have to repay, election coming up. And actually, the contracts that you were being forced to sign, often with your fingerprint, weren't actually completely legal because there were interest rates higher than the theoretical but unenforced interest rate caps. So the microfinance sector suddenly had this awkward situation. The beneficiaries, the guys that are supposed to be, you know, like just so eternally grateful to us for lending them money, you know, we're their saviors. They are the ones who started this. And so that was a serious alarm bell. That was probably a real panic in the sector at that point, because people were thinking, if this spreads to other countries, it's history. And it didn't. They managed to calm that one down.
I was going to say, we can learn something from that group.
Yeah, I know. I say, you know, power to the people. I think that was a great movement. I was really hoping Honduras was going to go, but yeah, they didn't.
You did talk a little bit about the inspirational group of entrepreneurs that you met in the Chiapas, a small group of women weavers.
Oh, well,
I like
this
story.
Yeah, these were actually the women weavers I mentioned before. This group of women, they had... it started off with like two or three women who, I think it was, they were either widowed or divorced or something like this. And so they were even more vulnerable than usual, because this was in an indigenous community, which is extremely male-dominated. So they got some loans and they started this weaving business. And then what happened was they got some, there was another woman who, I can't remember all the details, but she wanted to, you know, she was a victim of domestic violence, or she'd been raped, or something like this. So she basically wanted to flee the house that she was in, and so she went to the weavers and said, is it okay, can I join you, and I'll learn to weave. And then the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And gradually it formed into a kind of women's rights, you know, sort of like, you know, women power co-op where no men were allowed, and it was, you know, and it was financed by microfinance, yeah? And so that was a really good example of where microfinance not only enabled, like, income generating activities and people to get out of poverty, it actually shifted the social situation in this village. It's called Sinacantan in southern Mexico, and it's about 2,000 or 3,000 people. It actually shifted the whole gender role in this community in favor of women as a result of microfinance. So that was a great thing. What happened, of course, was after 5 or 6 loans, and once they'd got, you know, a critical mass of women working for them, they didn't need any more loans. They were profitable. And so they started, you know, just, they didn't need to leverage their business at all. They could cover all their costs, make profit, and so they stopped borrowing. So in a way, that's the ultimate proof of microfinance working, is you don't need microfinance at the end, yeah? But you'll never hear that. When was the last time you heard of a microfinance institution saying, we aim to lose our clients? It's all to do with retention. Our retention rate's falling. We need to retain them. You know, this is like one of the key statistics. And, you know, really, failure, you know, clients leaving is not failure. It's a complete success. These were the same clients that subsequently were being paid to pose as microfinance clients. Yeah. You know, they had a little side business, which was acting, basically. They were entrepreneurial, you know.
It's hard to know how many success stories we have like this, because there's so little transparency, right?
Yeah, yeah. And we shouldn't exaggerate how many success stories there are, because if you look at the poverty reduction, the macroeconomic poverty reduction in these countries, it is still pretty well zero. So we shouldn't exaggerate those. Yeah.
You know, I wonder, since you do have all of this experience in finance and you did get your MBA, I mean, you were kind of, you believed in this sort of capitalist system at one point, right? So, I mean, you've got some insights that those of us who have no connections to Wall Street don't have. What, how are you making sense of what we're facing right now with this mass, and I wonder what you think about what's happening in this country, with this massive gap between the rich and the poor. We have stagnant wages. People cannot find jobs. In California, 4 million people cannot afford to eat. I just heard in Dallas, Texas, for the first time ever, there's a domestic violence shelter. All the beds are taken. They're having to find hotel rooms for these families. I mean, I just wonder how you're sort of making sense of what we're facing based on the experience you have.
I mean, it's a huge topic, but I mean, you know, I'm generally, my time in banking taught me some things, and my time in microfinance has made me very, very scared of just debt in general. I just, you know, there's a book by Milford Bateman, which was really interesting, because he, at the beginning of his book, he looked at all the major religions and all the major languages and all the major teachings, and just looking at the origin of the word debt and the various translations. And, you know, for thousands of years, it's always had this connotation of enslavement, of evil, of servitude, of vulnerability, of desperation. It's generally a word associated with badness. And then what we've managed to do in the last, you know, maybe since the Second World War in developed countries, and then now with the advent of microfinance, is we've managed to kind of turn it into a good word. Like, you've got to have a credit card. You've got to, if you want that car, just buy it on credit. You know, you want to get $1 million house, but you've only got a $50,000 salary. It doesn't matter. Just get a massive, great big mortgage. So we've kind of created this credit culture, which, I mean, you guys in America know a lot more about it than I do. That hasn't gone entirely smoothly here. And Europe is, let's face it, is not doing particularly well. And so now we're forcing this onto poor people as well. Mm. But we're forcing it onto poor people who don't have even the US level of financial literacy, which probably isn't that high. It's not high enough. Yeah. And these people are vulnerable. They're signing the contracts with their fingerprints. They don't know what they're getting into. It's not that they're stupid. I think that they just, you know, it's not bad that they get into these problems. They just don't know what to do. They think that it's a good idea, so they get a loan, and then, oh, they can't repay it, so they get another one to pay off the first one. And, you know, they don't realize that they're on this slippery slope until it's too late. And I just think it's a real pity that the mistakes that we've made here, it's not that we're not learning from them in the developed countries. We're doing it even worse. We're just doing even more reckless lending. I mean, I just think it's extremely sad. And I don't see how, until we actually just stop this culture of, you know, the only way to get ahead in life is if you borrow money. And, you know, if you borrow money at 50, 60, 100, 195% interest, it's just not going to work. I do not believe that it will work. But,
and they're often living with corrupt governments supported by the United States, their own governments not dealing with poverty. So, I mean, if you're going to get a $200 loan to possibly buy, I mean, I was reading about this today, they're buying, you know, new gadgets for their kitchen or you name it.
Let's not feel, I mean, really, there's a really central, you know, example that I use in the book, which is this Nigerian institution. And it's lending to women in the Niger Delta. And now, unfortunately, it's all over Nigeria. And, you know, it's having, let's just say, there's no documented evidence of progress. It's charging these interest rates of, the highest rates are 144% right now, but they're usually around about just closer to 100, 110, 120, those sorts of rates, yeah? And so, is it likely to have any impact? There's no evidence of that so far. But who are the investors in this specific institution? You know, and it is Deutsche Bank, Citibank, Blue Orchard, Standard Chartered, Grameen Foundation USA, Calvert, Kiva. I mean, these are the people that are doing this. You know, they're providing the fuel for this. It's not necessary that we have to have these banks lending at 125%. They couldn't do it on their own. They can only do it thanks to us giving them the money and turning a blind eye. That's what is so awful. I mean, if we just stop doing microfinance, that might be the best thing that we could, the best impact that we could have on the poor. Certainly in that institution, it would be better to just withdraw, just pull your money out, have the bank go bankrupt, and then you're just going to, you're not going to have any positive impact. You're just going to have a slightly reduced negative impact. And in many cases, that's really all you can hope for. Now, this is the problem.
So it's that bad? I mean, you really think that the industry should just go away?
Well, no. There's the throwing the baby out with the bathwater problem is that, you know, if you just stopped all microfinance, then there are a few good institutions that would suffer as a result of that. And there are a few clients in all these institutions that are actually benefiting from microfinance. So this, if you just take that really blunt step and just say, that's it, we're not doing any more microfinance, then there would be, I think you call it in America, collateral damage. Mm. Is that your famous word? there would be people who suffer. Would the overall impact be positive or negative? Well, given that the overall positive impact is neutral now anyway, if you stop the whole thing, it probably wouldn't have a particularly bad negative impact. There was a case a couple of weeks ago when yet another scandal broke to do with a very high bonus paid to the former CEO of Axion, who got a journalist in Denmark revealed that she'd got a total remuneration of $2 million during the IPO of Compartamos. She now works in the Obama administration, which is astonishing. But, when this scandal broke, it was the second scandal that had broken in Norway in a relatively short period of time. And the Norwegian government said, that's it, no more microfinance. We're just pulling out entirely. So there's no more public money coming from Norway for microfinance, which is really sad because they're big investors. They're now actually some of the best investors. They're some of the more astute ones. And they just said, you know what? This is just so dirty that we're pulling out. And they made one exception. They said, we'll still invest in Sudan, but the rest of the world out. And, you know, in a way, I totally understand why they did that, you know. But then on the other hand, you sort of think, well, you know, if there was anyone who could actually make a positive impact, of all the investment funds, you know, it's probably actually the Norwegians are some of the brightest ones, are some of the least profit motivated and the most astute investors. And yeah, they've just pulled out. So that, I think, is really negative. And I hope, I say in the book so many times that the editor actually said, you've got to cut some of these out because you're getting repetitive. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Mm. And, you know, it's a fine line because if this goes too far, if we're going to have another spate of suicides and another spate of whatever, it could go that way. And I think that's the danger. But if you do, what's the alternative? To just do nothing and pretend that everything's okay?
What is she doing in the Obama administration?
Oh, I know. She's Under Secretary of State for Global Affairs. I think that was it. The revolving door. So you do the IPO, you get your $2 million, and then you go and work in the White House. So she's a big supporter of for-profit microfinance and IPAs, I believe.
Were you in touch with women's organizations in the countries you visited? Are they aware of what's going on? Are they taking any action on this?
Yeah, it's an interesting development because my wife actually works for the women's movement, so she's very well aware of, you know, not microfinance related so much, but just the general suffering of women in developing countries. And there is now the sort of first signs that the women's movement is waking up to this idea that although they've never really been directly involved in microfinance, that actually they need to start getting involved in microfinance to protect the women from microfinance. It's getting to that point now where what you're going to start seeing increasingly, it has happened a couple of times already, you're actually going to start seeing NGOs setting up particularly to advise women on their legal rights, because they don't know their legal rights. Often there are good laws in these countries, but they're not aware of them. You're going to start seeing NGOs to protect women from NGOs, which is slightly ridiculous. The other issue is the child labour. There's another secret kind of skeleton in the closet, which is that when these women do build up their little businesses, they're very labour intensive, high volume, low margin, labour intensive businesses. Where do they get the extra employment? You know, they use their kids. So there is this growing concern now that actually what we've created inadvertently is a massive child labour problem. So if you look, the ILO published a report recently about child labour in Latin America. On average, it's 10%. 10% of children work illegally, yeah, according to the ILO standards. The two highest countries are Bolivia and Peru, and they are 28%. So that's getting to pretty serious child labour. Now, where do those children work? Formal sector or informal sector? It's 99% in the grey economy. Little shops and stacking shelves and things like this. And in which countries in Latin America do you see the greatest abundance of microfinance? Microfinance that only works in the informal sector, Peru and Bolivia. So I'm not saying that there's causality. You can't say that there's a causal effect. But what you can say is that we've got a big grey economy, you've got a lot of child labour, and we've got a big grey economy, you've got a lot of microfinance. Now, people are beginning to wake up to this as well, because this is also quite embarrassing. And you imagine, this is on top of all the other problems that the sector is already facing. The women's issue and the child labour issue. It's just, you wonder where it's going to end, to be honest.
So you're going to have women's groups try to prevent women from taking microloans.
Well, I mean, potentially. I mean, I've come across, I'm not going to say that there's one institution that only does this, but I mean, I've come across quite a few women-focused NGOs in developing countries that really try to work with women to warn them about what's going on and to help them when they get into trouble. Yeah, I think that's...
I mean, it's people called in, they were shocked by this information. I got emails after the show from people who said, this is utterly shocking, because I thought that by giving my $50 or $100, it was actually doing good.
You can't say that it's not doing good, because you need to trace that 50. Some of them do good, yeah? But what are the probabilities? Yeah, you have to look at it in terms of probabilities. If you put your money into one of these intermediaries that's going to supposedly help eradicate poverty on your behalf for a small commission, what are the odds of that actually helping the poor person? It's very, very low. When you look at the research, it's extreme. There's no impact so far. So why would your money suddenly be any different to the entire money that's been invested so much, $70 billion? And what is the odds of you being deceived by that intermediary? Very, very high. So you've got probability of getting ripped off, extremely high. Probability of actually helping a poor person, extremely low. You put those two things together, and in my opinion, you don't really have a very sensible business model. But that's my opinion.
Right, because I mean, the argument, and I'm sure many of you would make it, they're living under corrupt government. There's no way they could get a loan from a bank. And so this is the only option. And if this isn't here, then what else is there?
Yeah, this is the so-called unemployed moneylender theory,
right,
which is that because we've now created this wonderful industry of microfinance, all the moneylenders are now unemployed. But that is complete nonsense. The moneylenders have never been doing so well, particularly as they can now come in and fund the microfinance clients when they need to go back to the microfinance institutions. Yeah, and this idea that there's no alternative, that if you need credit and a microfinance bank is offering it to you at 150%, if your alternative was 200%, then that's better. Well, no. If the alternative was don't get a loan and don't do a stupid business idea that if you make 20% but you lose 150%, if the alternative is don't do it, then I would say that is probably your best chance. I mean, if you look at Grameen Foundation USA, based in DC, they defended the interest rates of their investment in LAPO, the Nigerian institution, publicly defended it with the argument it's cheaper than the money lenders. And it's like we're saying that if you've got a corrupt bank run by a bunch of family members, including family members as the external auditor, you're charging up to 144% interest a year. You're illegally taking savings and on-lending them, according to the rating reports. The first bank to ever get its own rating withdrawn because it was found to have lied to the rating agency. Yeah, it then suffered the biggest rating downgrade in history. in microfinance history, from B plus to C plus in one go, in 1 year, for a bank with, I think it was about 400,000 clients. And then someone stands up and defends this institution, saying it's better than the next guy, because there's actually someone even worse than that. That is really the only argument that Grameen Foundation offer. And I'm just sort of sitting there going, so because the person could have been slightly more damaged, you justify your investment in this institution, which happens to be extremely profitable and is just transferring into a private limited company, at which point I wonder who's going to get the shares. And if we're going to do the next Compartamos IPO, where is it going to happen in Africa? Lapo is they call it the Compartamos of Africa, you know? It's somewhat farcical. But this is sometimes that's the only argument in their favor. It's the only one they've got left.
Well, right, because what you were just explaining, you were referring to Grameen, and this is the institution, other than Kiva maybe, that is put on a pedestal, really.
It's put on a pedestal, and the most unbelievable thing about Grameen Foundation USA is that Muhammad Yunus is on its board. And Muhammad Yunus is one of the most vocal critics of extortion interest rates. I mean, he hates it. He has done entire speaking series on your interest rates cannot be more than 15% in addition to your cost of capital. So you get your capital at 10%. Okay, you can charge 25%. And with that spread, you can cover your costs, and that's reasonable. We can argue all day whether 15, 12, 20, it doesn't really matter. He's talking about figures of that sort of magnitude. And yet you have Grameen Foundation USA investing in, you know, what in my definition would be a money lending organization, charging the moment you go above 100%, there's just absolutely no defense whatsoever. And no comment. No comment yet. Because, of course, if there was a tension between Muhammad Yunus and Grameen Foundation USA, that would cause a catastrophic impact in the US microfinance sector. Imagine if Muhammad Yunus said, "Right, this is it. I'm not. You're not using my name and associating me with this institution." That would be a run on the entire microfinance sector of this country. That would be front page of every newspaper. So it can never happen. It has to be kept under control. And so what do we see a few months later when the New York Times broke the story of Lapo, after all the rating downgrades, after all this sort of stuff had happened? A few months later, of all the institutions in Africa to get the Entrepreneur of the Year Award, the Schwab Foundation gave the Entrepreneur of the Year Award to Lapo. It's just unreal. Now, who sits on the board of the Schwab Foundation? Go figure, he's got a Nobel Prize. So you have this ambiguity as to what actually is going on in this sector, because on the one hand, you've got people preaching about extortion is happening and we've got to stop it. And that's nice. And everyone sort of in this room goes, that's good. At least there are people standing up and saying that this extortion shouldn't happen. But, you know, where's the action?
Well, right. What will it take to really shake up this industry? I mean, if you're saying that these institutions are not responding and they're sort of, do you think they're laying low and hope that the dust settles, you'll be off to Colombia, the media will move on and call it a day?
Yeah, I think that's right now that's their only strategy. They just need to just keep this quiet. There's no way to defend it now. It's all out. Everyone knows. It's like, you know, the cat is out of the bag. And so all they can hope for now is that it will just blow over. You know, I can't imagine what other strategy. Because the other thing which these guys are very worried about in the book is that not only is all the evidence on the website, but they know, like people who read the book don't know this, but they know and I know that not everything is in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So when they're sitting there saying, right, we're going to, you know, sue this guy or whatever, you know, because, you know, we'll find one little sentence that we can criticize him on. In each of the institutions, there's at least one person who's going to be saying, listen, there's something I need to talk to you about. He didn't actually talk about this, and that would be really awkward if that came out, you know. So they themselves know this. There's another Berit Kohler book called The Whistleblower Handbook. Rule number 2, I think it is, in the Whistleblower Handbook is never put all your cards on the table at once. Yeah, always keep something up your sleeve. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do, but I don't think they're going to do much.
How much do you have up your sleeve?
Oh, there's...
Really? Yeah, I mean, you've got some explosive things coming.
Yeah, I mean, if necessary. I mean, let's see what happens. But yeah, if necessary. I mean, my argument to all these people, I mean, come on, Grameen, bring it on. Calvert, bring it on. Kiva, where are you? I'm in your city. In D.C., I was there, like, you know, where's World Relief? Where's Calvert? Where are all these people? You know, come bring it on.
Did you try to get appointments with them?
No, to be honest. Didn't want to push it too far. No, I mean, I spoke to one of them informally, but no. I'm just waiting for them to... Because the other thing is that doing things privately is useless. I've published this book. If they need to publish their response. If they want to tear the book to pieces, come on, do it. But do it openly, yeah? And you know, tell me why, and I will respond. But don't just sit there. I mean, come on. You've got so many people employed in pure spin. I mean, it's like 10% of the entire employment in the sector is just in spinning, you know, propaganda. You know, get all those juicy photos of the goats and things and just go do a turbo boost. But no, just nothing, just silence, which is, you know, either eerie and scary, or it's proof that maybe something's going to change.
We're going to take your questions in just a couple minutes, so if you have any, get them ready. We had one question today from a listener who said, what would transparency look like? And you said, well, how about just tell us what your interest rate is? That would be one piece of information that you'd like to know.
Even if you can get a piece of information even more obvious, tell us who you invested in.
And that's not readily available.
Not readily available. Very few funds even tell you who they invested in. You can, you know, you put your money into any of these funds. Go onto their websites. Just say, which institutions did you put that? Some of these funds are $500 million. Where did you invest it? It's not available. They'll tell you a regional breakdown, no more.
It seems like we need some investigative reporters to really look into this. Have there been many in-depth investigations other than this New York Times piece?
The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are your two best sources of information about microfinance. Forget the microfinance community. They're completely useless in presenting decent information. Those are the two newspapers you should read. And, you know, there's a thing now. The Guardian in the UK is also quite good, yeah? They've got, I mean, I can't prove this. It's not that they've said this officially, but there's a sort of word on the street is that there's like microfinance criticism fatigue. It's like we've done it before. We did a story last week. And yeah, we had this suicide. You know what? Can you do something else? I mean, because it's just everywhere. It's just everywhere, every day.
And I understand that you had two op-eds that were supposed to be published in a major institution, and they decided not to publish them, and they didn't tell you why, and they didn't call you back.
Yeah, that was a little bit... I began to get paranoid at that stage, I have to say. But, yeah, because there's a lot of powers behind this. This doesn't just stretch to the few funds. This is billions. This is now billions of dollars and seeps right into, you know, the governments. This is part of government strategy now. You know, the financialization of the poor.
$70 billion industry.
Yeah.
You also write, this is another good visual, I think I just lost this, just about the number of transactions that happen on a regular basis. You write about, 15,000? I mean, just to give people a visual of how this actually works, to show that it's not sort of a mom-and-pop operation. I mean, you're talking about people taking out loans and people paying back the loans.
Yeah, if you've got, I mean, some of these banks, for example, have got, say, 500,000 clients. And those clients are doing, you know, when you break it down to, you know, they're doing an interest repayment, a capital repayment, maybe a savings deposit or something. They're doing that maybe weekly. You can easily be having, you know, 4 million transactions a week, you know, going through these institutions, which have all got to be controlled, all got to be going through an IT system. I mean, this is not small little NGO people with pen and paper. This is hardcore banking under a different name and without regulation. Microfinance is no different to banking. That's all it is.
Do we have some questions? Yes.
No accident that Grameen started in South Asia, because bank-started subsidiary. It's called Ruhr Bank, which branches all over. Not only that, there were co-op banks. All of them failed. They became insolvent many times over. Money lenders did not. A study of the World Bank showed that in most areas, money lenders, although the rates were high, they were actually competitive. Not only that, they've been money lenders for generations, for hundreds of years. They knew everyone, they knew their capacity to do something, not do something, to make money, not make money, pay back, etc. So, as a part of a much larger reform package, what I suggested was actually, instead of setting up these institutions and branches that were in the end captured by politicians, by the managers, by the rich farmers, the banks should just give more money to the money lenders and let them handle it. And their rates actually were, as he said, the risks of this kind of lending is very high, and the monitoring costs are very high. So yes, they're higher than urban interest rates, but they're not necessarily usurious. And as long as you keep them competitive, it works. So I think that's still the answer.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this microfinance is a new word for money lending, except it's more usurious.
There's a really interesting case in they're called the Susu lenders in Ghana, I believe it is, and there's actually a peer-to-peer lending platform based in Denmark that is using these Susu lenders. So they say, right, I want $10,000, and so all the people in Europe, they chip in their money, and so the Susu lender gets this money, and so long as he agrees to only charge certain rates, and they are vaguely regulated, that's exactly what they do. They go around certain markets. And I mean, the other thing about the money lenders that people, they're always branded as the evil money lender that the microfinance institution has to replace. But there have been quite a few studies of the flexibility of money lenders. Actually, when you take into account the cash flows, sometimes the interest rates are not actually that high. They're actually a lot more flexible. They actually have less penalties. They don't come and break your legs, yeah. And actually, they are a serious competitor, and they're thriving. But the problem is that they're not as, you can't profit from that so much. If you're you can't IPO money lenders, yeah. So it doesn't appeal to this kind of ideology which we've created around. Yeah, here's another myth about the moneylender is, if you've got most microfinance clients, when they run into a cash flow problem, they just need some money for a few days, a few weeks, whatever. It's not that they need to do this 5-year investment plan. They're not building a dam. They just need a little bit of money for a short period of time. So you can go to a microfinance bank, and the microfinance bank will offer you a loan at 100%. The moneylender will offer you 200%, but he'll lend it to you for a week. And that's two. I'm talking about annual rates. I would rather pay an annual rate of 200% for precisely the period that I want than get locked into a 1-year contract or an 8-month. Very few of them go under 8 months, which is not actually what I need. I mean, what the poor really need is to smoothen the volatility of their income and expenses. And the best vehicle for doing that is not a loan, it's savings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So you save in the good times, and then when you run out of money, you can dip into your own savings. You're essentially you're borrowing from yourself. Yeah, that is a sensible solution. And there are institutions that focus exclusively on savings. Yeah? But how do you make money out of savings? You can't. There's no one to invest in a bank that just captures money and then gives it back to people. It's not profitable. So again, just forget it. This is the UN year of the co-op. Did anyone know that? Yeah, and savings and credit co-ops are as big as the whole of the microfinance sector in the world. Yeah, no one's talking about it, but actually that is a hell of a lot better, because who owns the savings and credit co-op? The people. So what's the point in exploiting yourself? Yeah, and look at all the hype that we had in 2005. Oh, the year of microcredit, blah blah blah. It's on every street corner. Next year, Nobel Prize for microcredit. Well, hang on. What about the savings and credit co-ops? I mean, some of these have been around for hundreds of years, mm-hmm. but, it's just not profitable.
Mm-hmm. So, having heard what you have to say,
So when we do that, where would we put it?
How do we solve world poverty? Yeah, it's. I don't have a sensible solution to this. Yeah, but my view is, this is my personal opinion. Yeah, I would rather not try this microfinancing with my money, especially as I'm already invested in it quite a bit with like a whole career in it. But I would rather actually give my money to effective NGOs. Like right now, if someone said to me, you've got to put 10,000 into, you know, whatever, I would fund a women's focused institution giving women legal advice on getting out of debt crises. Hmm. That's what I would do with my money now. No, and currently I'm not even aware of them existing, so it'd be startup capital, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Yes.
I think microfinance plus, like credit plus other activities, is very good. Yeah, you know, with financial literacy, with all these, with healthcare, I think that is probably one of the ways ahead. Obviously, when you start adding these extra costs that you're, you know, to service the clients in these additional ways, if you expect to do this with the same profit margins, so you're charging the poor for that service, then you're going to end up with extortion interest rates. So it requires a built-in subsidy model. So for as long as you've got investors who are willing to do this on a subsidized basis, then I don't see that there's a problem with it. I think that that's really useful. And in actual fact, what you might find is a situation where you've got a microfinance institution that's offering healthcare, you know, insurance, savings, you know, whatever. And actually, it turns out that people don't actually want any loans anymore, which would be, you know, somewhat ironic, but I think that's what you could have. You see some institutions who start offering savings, and 5 years later, they've got more savings than they have loan portfolio, because that's really where the demand is. With regards to the Kiva partners that they seek out, yeah, and you know, that they seek only the good ones, well, do look at the statistics of the number of Kiva partners. I believe they've had about 180 partners, of which they've now got something like 80 or something. So there is, okay, I'm using data from, I mean, it's in the book. I've got all the data to the end of 2010. There's quite a high rate of dropout of people who start using the microfinance institutions that use Kiva and then drop out, yeah? And then you have the cases of, okay, I'm not suggesting that Kiva only lends through evil moneylender institutions. You know, I would say, so far, yeah. I mean, BRAC, Sudan. There's a couple of the Mexicans I'd be a bit worried about. But I mean, I think I list three or four questionable institutions of the, you say now, 160 microfinance institutions. So I'm suggesting that there are currently four that are worth investigating. So I agree with you in principle. To be honest, my issue with Kiva is not actually to do with that level of Kiva. I think they've got perfectly decent microfinance institutions. I'm more concerned about the interest rate and ultimately about who Kiva is actually attempting to service. But.
Thank you. On this side.
In this morning's program, recipient set the rate, and I wonder if you might comment that that would deal with the interest problem. The second question I would like to ask is whether you might be interested in setting up a microfinance rating organization, since that's what needs to be done.
Yeah, the what's it called, Zadisha? There's actually a couple of institutions that have started up since then. I mean, that's really good because you force, they have, it's slightly complicated because they have a fixed fee that you have to pay, blah, blah, but it ends up that you know that the loan is going to be lent out at 10%, or I think it was it a bit higher, 15%, something like that.
10 or 12.
Yeah, very reasonable interest rates, yeah? That would be absolutely wonderful. Now, obviously, what they've got to do is they've got to actually have the control right the way down to the field to make sure the loan is actually being charged at that rate. The difference between that and Kiva is that Kiva doesn't get involved in the transaction that takes place in the field. What they do is they just give the money to the microfinance institution and then it does what it wants. Yeah, it charges the rate that it chooses. Yeah, and sends the photos back to California. So that's the difference. I mean, I think the Zadisha model is really good. With regards to rating agencies, it's a really good question. There are, in the book, yeah, I discussed like all the various different players. So you've got the funds, I discussed the rating agencies in some detail. There are two rating agencies which are really absolutely excellent in microfinance. One's called MicroRate and one's called Planet Rating. And what these guys do, they go in, they look at institutions and they do, I mean, they pass the two key tests of a rating agency, which, to be honest, the S&P and Fitch and all these people don't necessarily pass. A, they're very accurate, yeah, so they are an extremely reliable source of information on a microfinance institution. And B, they're predictive. So they don't just tell you what's just happened, like, you know, S&P say, oh, we think Spain might go bankrupt. Yeah, thanks for telling us that now, yeah. And these guys actually will publish reports saying, we're very worried about this, 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 and this. These rating agencies exist, yeah? The problem is the microfinance investment community don't read the ratings. In fact, it's even worse. It's not that they don't read them. In the case that I document in the book, the Nigeria case, is that the rating agencies were talking about all the problems, yeah? Publicly available documents for free. You could just download them off the internet. You had all the issues of the interest rates, all the issues of not having a banking license and taking the savings, all the issues of family members, all the issues of fraud with the savings. They discussed all these issues. It was publicly available, and they still invested. So that raises the point. It's not that we need a rating agency. It's like, what's the point of having a rating agency if no one reads the ratings? You know, that's the really sobering, worrying thing about this. I mean, there was one institution that I spoke to, that after they had invested in this institution in Nigeria, I asked them, you know, what was your due diligence when you invested in this institution of all of them? And they were like, well, but just a sort of general. And I was like, did you read the ratings? No. I was like, did you go to the institution? No, because it's dangerous. And I was like, did you read the front page of the New York Times? No. But they put couple of million dollars of other people's money into the institution. I mean, what can you do? You slap it on the front pages of the New York Times and they don't listen because it's extremely profitable. Yeah, the profit motive just dominates.
You have to get to the airport, so we have time for one more question. Yes.
Do you have a plan with Rick Kohler to write another book since you have all this stuff up your sleeve?
Well, yeah, it's potentially an interesting idea, but right now, I want to put this book behind me. I'm going to get on a flight. Unfortunately, I've got to do a work project this week, and then I'm just going to go home, turn off the computer, turn off the telephone. I'm going to just spend at least 2 or 3 months, and I'm going to wait and see if these guys actually have the guts to stand up and actually start doing something. And then we'll see what happens next. But it's going to be a war.
If Nicholas Kristof calls, will you answer?
He'll have to explain to me. He'll have to reconcile his previous comments with the academic literature. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Hugh, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.